Just let me hear some of that rock and roll music. Any old way you choose it. It's got a backbeat, you can't lose it. Any old time you use it. It's gotta be rock and roll music. If you wanna dance with me. If you wanna dance with me. I have no kick against modern jazz. Unless they try to play it too darn fast. And change the beauty of the melody.
Greetings, programs, and welcome to another episode of Quirks and Recreation. I'm co-host Doug.
I'm another co-host Brandon.
And we have a special guest today.
Hey there, I'm Kyle.
And Kyle here is to help us with our topic, which is the science of music. We've got kind of a lot of different stuff to cover with music, but Kyle's on guitar. I've got a keyboard in front of me. And Brandon, you're just going to have
I'm on voice.
You've got to make whatever noises you can with your mouth if we have to.
I can do a lot of that.
So I thought, I was looking at your outline, Kyle. I think where we can start off here, you've got the way the ear processes music. So I think that's a great place to start. How do your ears actually hear music?
Yeah, it's an important thing. If you're talking about the science of music, and really just music in general, it's how we interpret music and the emotion that it gives us.
Yeah. But before that, it's got to get into your ear hole.
It's got to get in there. You have to be able to hear with your ear.
Yeah. If you can't hear, the music is going to be a little bit lost on you. So,
boring.
Yeah. So, Brandon, do you ever study the ear in science class or how it works?
Yeah, I have.
Okay. What can you tell us about the ear?
There's like an eardrum.
Okay.
You probably need that.
You do need it. It really hurts if you bust it. But the eardrum isn't really there for hearing. What the eardrum does is it blocks, it just blocks things from getting into your ear where they're not supposed to go. Sort of the same way, you've got a lot of parts of your body, like your eyelashes block crap from getting into your eyes, right? But the sound that you hear, there's a part of your ear called the cochlea. So if you were to go into your ear hole and keep going and going and going farther and farther, you would go past the eardrum and come to a little seashell-shaped organ inside, and it curls around. And on the inside of that, there are a bunch of little tiny hair-like structures. And when sound vibrations come through the air and into those structures, they cause those little hairs to move back and forth. At the bottom of the little hairs is a nerve ending. So as it moves, it stimulates the nerve ending, and it sends a signal to your brain. And your brain is able to interpret all of those little signals as everything you hear. You know, that's pretty much how you process sound. So, make sense?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen someone with like a little machine on the side of their head?
Hearing aid?
Well, there's hearing aids for when you're old. And all those do is they take the sound that come in.
Into your ear.
Yeah, they reproduce the sound much louder. Because as you get older, some of those hairs die. Those hair-like structures die, and now you have less sensitivity to sound. But people who are outright deaf or have significant hearing loss, sometimes that can be corrected with what's called a cochlear implant. And that's a machine that fits on the side of your head, and rather than just make the sound louder, because that won't work for someone who's deaf, what it does is it bypasses the cochlea and they tap it into the nerves that go to your brain and send a signal that way and bypass everything. And that machine has allowed a lot of people who are completely deaf or have severe hearing loss to actually hear the world around them.
Also so. Rich people.
Well, yeah, they're not cheap. But, Kyle,
maybe good insurance will help that.
Yeah, you need insurance. But
Allstate.
Yes, that's sponsored by Allstate today. But you mentioned an important part, Kyle, which is the emotion of music. And I think that's really,
what's key. Because that's what it comes down to, what people like. People that like rap music and classical and country music and all that stuff. It's basically the emotion that they get from the sound that they hear. And if you think about sound, really, or just music in general, it starts off with just tones.
Right. Each note is a tone, and that tone can be described using mathematics. So, for example, I believe it's an A note on the scale, which sounds like this. Okay, that's an A. An A note vibrates the air at 220 hertz. Hertz is a measurement for how quickly the sound wave goes up and down, up and up and up and up and down. So the higher a note is, those sound waves are going to be much, much, they're going to go up and down the same, but they're going to be squished closer together. So what's interesting is there's a mathematical correspondence. So a middle A is 220 hertz. the high A is going to be exactly double that. It's going to be 440 hertz. And each of the notes on the scale have the same mathematical relationship to each other. So middle C, if you double the hertz, you get to high C. Same with all of these notes. They're the same distance apart proportionally. Kyle, you want to talk
about that? Yeah, you know, just kind of going on that, it just reminds me of when I was in high school and I took a computer class, and one of the things that I figured out how to do in like a basic DOS back in the 90s, you know, when we were in high school and stuff, was is you can figure out a way to actually make a sound by, you type in the frequency, and eventually you can actually make a song, which develops into music programs, to computer music and MIDI, and it kind of goes from there.
Sure, if you were to pop in an old NES cartridge from old school, like Atari or, Nintendo games, those would have to make music digitally, and it would be exactly that. It would be a program that would say, make a tone at 220 hertz or 231 hertz.
Yeah, and I think back then, all those, you know, Super Mario Brothers theme song, which everyone knows. Right, and you compare that.
You know it, and you were born in the 2000s.
And you can compare that to probably some game like Call of Duty now. You can probably have a whole orchestra behind it, or you probably have more like Metallica on a game like that. But
sure.
But the way that the computer can just take these little sounds, and from the way that we've come to technology now, is we can produce thousands of sounds all at one time.
Yeah, what's really kind of cool about the tonal structure and the mathematical relationship of one note to another, there's these certain notes that we all know and prefer. So, for example, when something is quote-unquote in tune, that means, for example, if I play a middle C that's in tune, it's exactly at the right number of hertz. But if I take that note and I bend it down or up a little bit, it sounds weird, right? It doesn't sound like it's supposed to be. We're used to hearing it here. So Kyle's got a guitar in front of him.
Yeah, so a good example of that is something like dissonance is when you have something that's off by a little bit. Mm-hmm. So you can take a low E and a high E. This is actually going to be two octaves of E. So I'm going to play right now is an E and then an E two octaves higher. So it sounds... Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, just so you know, what we should describe what an octave is. So an octave is one scale. It comes oct because there's eight notes in a scale. So a C scale would be, right? We come back to where we started just a little bit, just the higher version of that. That's one unit of a scale. So Kyle is going to go two octaves apart.
Right. So if we call this one, and then the middle one would be somewhere like here, and then the high one would be here. So that sounds in tune. There's nothing really that sounds wrong. You can probably hear that and be like, I don't really know what that is, but it sounds okay.
And they're right mathematically. Like we said, it would be, we'd go from 220 to exactly 440. They are now perfectly double, so they sound correct. The sound waves match each other.
But now if you hear something like this, everyone's going to notice that something just doesn't sound right. It just sounds like it's just messy on the ear. I just don't like this. What that is that's an E, and then up on the octave is a high F above that, which is one half step.
Right. Like we sort of said, that there's eight notes in the scale. Well, between those notes, there are half steps. So instead of going, if I put the half steps in there, it would be...
Chromatic. Well, we can call that in music as chromatic half steps.
Right. Those are chromatic half steps. And what's cool is, have you ever heard of a key change, Brandon? You're shaking your head no. So a key change is, if we're doing a song that's in C, like a classic kind of song, you want to hit a C. So, what's a good... Jingle Bells.
Probably a good way to do it is think of a chord progression that's just something basic like... You can take that same thing in a different key and be... Which is really the same thing done in a different key.
We've just shifted it higher. So, for example, if we were talking in mathematical numbers, we would be going, let's say, 2, 4, 6, right? Those are each two numbers apart. Well, now we've bumped it up to 14, 16, 18.
So, like the song, like da-da-da-da-da-da-da, like you can go higher and higher.
You can play that in any key you want, right?
Right. Any song can be moved, it's called transposing. So you can take a song that's in one key and just shift it over and do it in another, as long as you move all of the notes up or down the proportional number of notes that you need to move it. So if we've gone up three half steps on one note, every single note in that song has to move up three half steps, and they'll all be right where they need to be. the song will just sound a little bit higher pitched or lower pitched, depending on what you want.
What's interesting about the whole numbers thing is you say there's eight notes, right? And really, the eight is really the one. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 is the same as one.
Of a major scale.
And the way that it works, and actually professional musicians, if you're in the studio and they say, play a song in G, here's a G chord, and they say, I need a 1, 6, 4, 5, they're basically saying they want the one chord progression, the six chord progression, the four, and the five. So it would be 1, 6, 4, 5. Then they say, I want a 1, 4, 5. 1, 4, 5. There's just so many different versions of it that you can throw in them.
And
making music.
But what's really cool is, like, Brandon, give me a song that you like. Like, what's a song that you think of? Like, I know you're... What's your favorite band?
My favorite band? Aerosmith.
Okay, great. That's a great... So what's your favorite Aerosmith song?
What It Takes.
Okay. I don't know how to play What It Takes, but tell me a little bit about, you know, how that song makes you feel when you hear it.
I like it.
Okay. What do you like about it?
The words. I like the, like, the background, like, the instrumental.
You know what's really great about that song? I know that song. I mean, Brandon knows that I love What It Takes, too. Is that song is an example that actually has a key change in it, which I bet most people don't know. In What It Takes, I can actually play it.
Okay. And then play a little of it. So this is the real one. And you can hear the... What key is that in?
Well, I think... I don't know. Probably G, but I'm sure they transposed it somewhere.
Right. At a certain point, the song jumps up to a higher key.
Right.
Now, what that does, emotionally, I'm going to kind of explain what that does to the person who's hearing it.
It really has some sort of a shift. And actually, if you can let it play here, because when we get to the chorus, you're going to notice that all of a sudden, you're going to feel like you're in a different place when you get to the chorus. You're going to be kind of cruising along here. We're not quite there yet. You're
right.
Cruising along, and then when you get to Tell Me What It Takes to Let You Go, you're really going to feel like you're in a different place.
It's like the song kind of bursts
it
open, right?
Yep.
Right.
Here it comes. This is in a second here, and you're going to feel in the first note of the chorus. Here it comes.
Did you hear that song, that chord on the downbeat where it went bonk first before it jumped up? So, we'll turn it off here. You want to explain a little bit more about what that means by a downbeat, or?
Well, a downbeat is just basically, when you're playing, your basic song isn't really a time signature. 4-4 is your basic time signature, which there's four beats. So it's like 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. So when you said downbeat, you meant the first beat of the bar, which is
right.
Really the one.
Exactly. So we should talk a little bit about time signatures too. So any song you hear has to have some sort of a beat, right?
Sure.
So Brandon, why don't you pound out a little bit of a beat here, just a straightforward. What you think any song would play? Just go, make something up.
Like,
no, with like a percussion, the drums of a beat. So.
So usually you got to think rhythm because of for time. So you got to think something like basic is.
Right. We all know this one.
It's in 4-4. You can count it because every time you do it, if you can do it while I'm counting.
Sure. Go ahead. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3.
Which would actually be halftime of that. It would be 1, 2, 3, 4. That's a pattern.
Right. That's how you have any sort of drum beat as a pattern. And I can play a song.
What is that called? Rhyme scheme?
Rhyme scheme would be the way the words and the lyrics match up. This is, we're talking about rhythm and tempo. So tempo is the speed of the song.
Correct.
The time signature is the type of pattern that we're using. So what we're talking about is a 4-4 time signature. What that means is you've got each little discrete piece of the song is four groupings of four beats. So most of the music you hear, especially pop or rock or hip-hop, is in 4-4.
Done.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2. Okay, so that's going to be most songs. Let me see if
there's some other very common time signatures, like 3-4 and 6-8 are very common too.
Mm-hmm.
We can get into those.
Now, we can also play what things sound like when the time signature is off. This is considered to be one of the worst songs ever written, and I'm really excited to play it. And you'll hear one of the reasons it's so bad is the time signature makes no sense. Wait, that's not it. Is this it? No? Well, that's bad.
What? It's just creepy.
It's horrible, right?
I
that's not even the original. I couldn't find...
Can you type of that?
Yeah, I can't. So let me play something else. Let me see if I can find this one. This is a song that I think is in a 5-7 time signature.
I have never heard a 5/7 before.
Yeah, this is going to be pretty odd sounding. It'll sound normal, but when you try and count it out...
So the way that it works, though, when you talk about 4/4, what that really means is that there's 4/4 is actually, it's a division, 4/4. The top 4 is how many beats are in the bar. The bottom 4 is the level, basically that would be a quarter note. If you're doing it in 4/4, it's a quarter note. You could do the same thing in 6/8, which means there's 6/8 notes.
Right. So here's one that's in a really weird time signature. Let's see how this sounds.
I hear a beat.
But listen.
Let's see if I can guess the time signature. I hear a beat.
You can hear a beat, but when you start to hear the words come in,
okay,
it's going to sound a little harder to match up because the time signature is kind of loopy. It's ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. They can hear kind of...
It's off.
But here's the thing. Obviously, the person who wrote the song, in this case, it's Sting.
There is some pattern going on in there.
There is a pattern. It's a complex pattern, and it's not one you're used to hearing. But the point, Brandon, that we've been sort of getting at is these are all tools to ping your emotions, right?
Create emotion, exactly.
Right. When you hear things that are different like that, it's the songwriter trying to put a different mood in your head. And that when you've matched that up, especially when the lyrics match up with the mood that they're trying to create, then all of that goes into the artistic expression of the music. So kind of getting back to the basics, major and minor chords, right?
Major and minor chords is your basics of what I would call happy and sad of music.
Mm-hmm. So I'll give you an example of a major chord here.
Before we get into
go ahead.
And this is still on the major minor thing, is what makes a major minor chord is if mm-hmm. you go to the piano and you play a C, a major is the third. So if you play one and the three together... Now, if you drop the third, anytime you drop the third, that's a minor chord. You see how there's a difference between happy and sad?
Well, immediately, it's not off,
it's
just...
It just sounds like dark.
Right, exactly.
Dark, exactly, is a perfect way to describe it. So if you think of a chord progression, I'm going to do a very basic chord progression that any musician out there will know. It sounds pretty pleasant, right? Mm-hmm. How many minor chords would you say are in there, Brandon?
Minor chords?
Sounds pretty happy, I mean...
Six?
Well, there's only 4 chords.
Oh.
So
he's playing some of them more than once.
So we have a major, and then listen to the minor, and you'll hear the sadness.
Yeah.
And then back to a major to resolve it. So there's definitely emotion in all the chords that you hear.
Yeah, and resolution, actually, he's used the word resolve. That's an important part of music, too. If you have a song that doesn't resolve, that leaves you with a different emotion, which is like, where is it?
So kind of like heavy metal or like...
No. This would be like it almost feels incomplete. So if you went... Happy birthday to you. And that was it?
Yeah. Or you can think of it just on a chord progression. You have like, this is very basic. You're going to feel like something's missing. You might not know it's missing until you hear the resolving at the end. So listen. Ready? Doesn't that feel
like
you got home?
Fast, like you're trying to do something.
The rhythm wasn't so important there.
But it was more the tone of bringing it in for a landing to that. Nah.
Right, you're kind of waiting for something, and then you get home.
I always do that, like, doesn't matter what it is, but I have to finish something. Like, there's, like, this song, I don't know what it is. I think it's a show called Family Guy.
Okay.
And, like, at the end of it, I, like, always make a beat at the end, because it sounds incomplete to me.
Is it the theme song of the
show?
Yeah,
like, at the very, like, the last, like, bit it, like, bah, and then I feel like there needs to be, like, another beat.
Yeah, it brings resolution to it, basically.
But, like, I feel like there should be more.
Well, sometimes creating emotion is leaving people hanging. You want people more.
Right, you want to leave people with that sense. Like, sometimes, like you said, if you could write a song that... You could write a song that's all minor chords. There's plenty of really, like, darker-sounding music, and that's what they're going for. So, if you go for, like... It could be a metal song, but there's plenty of metal songs that use major chords as well, but they tend to go more minor.
Yeah.
So, if you listen to, say, Metallica... You're going to hear a lot more minor chords than major chords.
What about, like, same with System of a Down?
Yep, the hard stuff is you usually get minor.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the things System of a Down, if you want to pick a band, one thing they do well is they'll do a lot of minor chords, and then all of a sudden, and then they also change tempo a lot, but all of a sudden the song will turn on a dime, and now for a brief moment, we're doing, you know, major chords and a happy sound, and then they go back into the minor chords again. And again, all that's to create drama. It creates emotion. And it's what I have been able to figure out. I was trying to look this up before the show. Is, you know, why are we hardwired that way? Like, why does this mathematical expression of tones, you know, of honestly, that makes us happy?
Yeah.
That makes us a little more apprehensive or sad.
I think a lot of it just might be like society and what we started with, going from the 50s and starting with happy Beatles, or 60s really, but Beatles and, you know.
And then just like gangster rock.
Well, you eventually got there. You had to get dark. You had to get through the 60s and get into Led Zeppelin first. But eventually, I mean, by the time now, and us adults here in the 2000s or kids, it's like we've heard all that stuff. We know what makes us happy and what makes us sad.
And I think you can go way, even way farther back than that. You can look at music from, say, the Renaissance or classical music, and it's the same thing. There's, you know, even though the tools they're using and the instruments they're using are to some degree different than what we have now, the basic idea is still the same. The structure of the music hasn't changed. It's, we know that these happy sounds are come in major chords. These, for some reason, this mathematical relationship of tones makes us feel these chemical emotions.
Is there anything in the middle? Or is that no?
Well, that's a good point. There are other kinds of chords that are more complex, right? Yes. All we've done, so to go from a major chord to a minor chord, is take the middle note and drop it down a half step. That's the only difference between a major and a minor chord.
So an interesting chord that you can try, and you know 1-3-5, right? So if you want to demonstrate a 1, take your 3 down 1, and then take your 5 and go down 1. That's called the diminished chord.
Right. We've dropped 2 of the notes down a half step. But what's interesting is,
so that's actually... Can that just be 1 step, though?
No.
It does not work like that.
It doesn't work. You can't drop a chord a step. That's transposing the chord. That's going from, say, here to...
Correct.
It's just a different major chord. I've moved everything down. But if I don't move all of them down the same amount, I've moved the 3 and the 5 down each a half step, but I've left the 1 where it is. Now I get that chord that we talked about before, which was a C diminished.
Correct. Another good one is an augmented chord, which is your 1-3 major, and you take your 5 and you go up. That's an augmented chord. Again, it doesn't really feel resolved. It feels like something's... And if you play that chord and you bring the 5 back down to where it should be, it'll feel very nice.
So when you're writing, if you were to be a songwriter, you would know these, you learn these different relationships between chords. And as you're putting your song together, you can, some people would take a different approach, but at least you know, all right, if I want to generate this kind of emotion, what if I did this kind of chord? And you can play around, and ultimately you find what serves your song best. We talked about a lot of different stuff about chords and chord theory, and then there's even more complex ones, like seventh chords, which is where I go 1-3-5.
That would be actually a major seventh. A true seventh would be when you drop that seventh down a half, which would be sound more bluesy.
Right. That's a very bluesy sound.
Can you do that again?
Do it again?
Yeah.
Okay, so I went one... Okay, that's a C major chord.
1-3-5.
If I go 1-3-5, seven...
Major seven, right?
Major seven. I'm playing C, E, G, B. I'm playing the higher B.
Higher B is the seventh note in the C scale.
But if I drop it down a half step, like Kyle said, just that last seventh note, I get a very bluesy, boogie-woogie kind of sound. And what you find is, as different genres of music developed over time, someone would experiment with this stuff. They'd find a sound. If people gravitated toward it and they found it interesting, then it would become popular and catch on. And if you look at, like I said, you start way back with some of the earliest music we've got, which is, say, Renaissance stuff, and you follow it through classical music, you'll see evolutions or different things. So, Kyle, what song are you looking for?
Well, we're talking about chord progression. There's actually songs out there that can jam a whole song on one chord. Can you believe that that's actually possible?
Paperback Writer is one of those songs, I think. It's all G. Here, sorry.
True. Actually, I was going to stick with the Beatles.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Tomorrow Never Knows.
Yeah, so check this out. I don't know if you'll see it in there.
Keep going.
One note, so does that mean it has to be like A the whole time or B the whole time?
It's not there on Spotify.
A sharp?
Sorry?
That's, like, does it mean it has to stay on one note the whole time?
That's a different song by the same title. So we can't do that one. But the point is, you can stick with a one chord the entire time. It's just going to, again, it's going to be, change the emotion of the song. But, for example, let me show you where different kinds of things can... translate. All right. So if I change here, let me go to an organ. No, that's not the one I want.
Nice organ there.
That's not the quite. I want a church organ. I want a real.
Does that mean that they could like like, if it's, say, like, Tomorrow Never Knows, I don't remember that song by heart.
Turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream. That one.
It just scored the whole way up.
Does that mean they change it, like, they change the sound of it, but keep the note, like, go higher or lower?
Sure. They're going to use other notes and beats around it to make that one chord actually interesting to the listener.
Right. Normally, most songs would have at least 2-3 chords, if not a lot more, because it gives you more places to go. But by confining it to that one chord, it makes the song feel kind of almost oppressive. Like, this song is closing in on you.
Why do drums sound different? Isn't it just hitting a beat?
Well, when you're talking about drums, you're really talking about more beats.
But why does it
tones.
Sound different? Because
you mean why do different drums sound differently?
No, just like boom, 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 boom. Like, what is it?
Those are actually tones on drums. You can actually have a whole set of drums and you can go, dick, doop, 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 doop. Those are different tones, believe it or not.
Right, and then it's just a matter of finding patterns of those that are interesting that, again, create different moods. So a really simple song would just be like, say, the White Stripes, just like boom, psh, boom, psh, boom, psh, for the entire song. Whereas, say, a band like The Police would do something...
Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
Some hi-hat, some bass drum, there's just some
all over the
crazy
place.
Cymbals going on.
And it's called... And they do a lot of what's called syncopation, where, so, in addition to, say, 1, 2, 3, 4...
1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and...
And a 5.
All their songs sound the same, though.
I don't think so. I love The Police. But, again, that's a matter of personal taste.
They're very talented.
They're super talented. But let me show you something kind of interesting. So, this is a piece of classical music that you've probably heard somewhere before, which is...
And you know why that is very dark? Because it's in a minor key.
It's all in D minor, right? So when you hear that, that's a very classical, it's called a Baroque sound. It's by Johann Sebastian Bach, and he likes what are called arpeggios a lot, which are very places where the notes go up and down. So you would get something like... We'll go
sounds
up and down.
Very like Scottish or banjo-y. Like.
Arpeggio is when you have your chord and you're basically playing all the notes in either a chord or something close to the chord.
And you're just going up and down and up and down and up and down through the chord. Whoa. But if I go to this song, and this is by a band called Muse.
I've heard of them.
Yeah, they've got a couple. This is not one of their hits, but listen to how much this sounds kind of like what I just played in its construction. See how it goes up and down, up and down, and up and down, and up and down. And it will continue to build and build and build as it plays. So that's just one way in which older music can influence modern music. Classical music here is influencing what they're doing.
Here's a good example of something like this, too.
Another one. This is Eruption. Van Halen. Up and down and up and down and up and down in the same chord.
It might be all over the place, but he's also going to be in the same zone.
Right.
This is Led Zeppelin?
This is Van Halen. Zeppelin has plenty of songs like this, too.
Sounds great than Led Zeppelin.
Well, Van Halen came after Led Zeppelin, but any band that came out, rock band that came after Led Zeppelin, was influenced by Led Zeppelin.
Yeah. Aerosmith, and any of those 70s, 80s, 90s bands.
Yeah. So, that's just sort of one way in which these same concepts, even though obviously the sound of a classical piece played by an orchestra is going to sound very, very different, the tools they're using are still the same.
Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? They're just different notes.
Yeah, maybe we should talk a little bit about how different instruments actually work. Do you know how any instruments work?
Or do you have any questions about any instruments?
Yeah, is there one you want to know how it works?
It's kind of a stupid one, but the triangle.
Okay.
Okay, how does the triangle work? Well, you can only do one thing with a triangle, right? Which
ding,
is
hit it.
Ding! Right. But it makes a very pretty and very distinct ding noise as opposed to just hitting any old random object around, right? Someone has engineered it to make that particular sound.
I'm going to bring out a different instrument here. I'll let you explain it, but here's a good one. A trombone.
Okay, that's a great one.
Heard of it, but don't know what it looks like. Oh, that one. I thought that was a trumpet.
No, a trumpet and a trombone work on the same concept. So a trumpet and a trombone are both what they
brass.
Call them. They're brass instruments, right? I actually played the trumpet a little bit in elementary school, so I think I've got some serious credentials here. But the way it works is you've got a little mouthpiece on the end of this long metal tube, right, that comes out at the end. And you put the mouthpiece up to your lips and you go... You go like that.
Really? So yep. That's what it would sound like if you have a microphone right up to you?
If you just had the mouthpiece without the trumpet attached to it, it would sound like that. But what happens is that vibration that you make, as opposed to, say, just blowing into the trumpet, if you go, that vibration carries, you know, the little air molecules are moving their way down this tube. And depending on the length of the tube, that controls what kind of note comes out at the end. The farther the air has to travel, the lower the note.
So can you think of an example, Brandon, of a brass instrument that has a really low tone?
A brass instrument that has a really long...
A low tone.
Low tone.
Like a really low
like
tone.
Like bass, like
a bass, right? Like, so do you know the name of a brass instrument? Can you think of one? It's probably going to be large.
Like the giant one that you hold on like your shoulder.
Right. Yep, that's the
one. That's called.
That's called a
tuba.
Tuba. And a trumpet would be some an example of a very high.
Right. A trumpet and a tuba are basically the exact same instrument. The only difference is the size.
More tube, less tube.
More tube, wider tube, narrower tube. And then within that trumpet's mechanical parts, you've got those three little tabs on top that people push. What those do is those open and close valves that control the pathway that the air is going to go. So
complicated.
It's complicated, but what if the trumpet had none of those? It was just a single tube. You can only make one note with it.
Well, and that's what's interesting about a trombone, because a trombone does not have those valves, right?
Right. The difference with a trombone is you do it by length. There's a part of that thing that slides back and forth. It's called a slide that moves back and forth.
Ooh, all the way up and down.
Does that mean how long the note stays for?
No, the note is as long as you can blow with your mouth.
It's the tone of the note, the frequency of the note.
The note, right, the frequency. So what happens is you're vibrating something, right? The more it has to vibrate for longer, you're stretching it out. You're stretching out the sound wave. So instead of having a sound wave that goes up and down, up and down, up and up and down, it's now going up and down and up and down, relatively speaking. So that makes it sound lower and lower. So the same principle applies to your guitar, Kyle. So you want to pull that up?
Sure. You can start off with a really, really low note. The very low note would be a low E. You can go all the way up to.
Sounds right. Like both those notes. The first one, that one, is in like one Metallica song. That one.
Yeah. That song is called One, and it's
actually
awesome.
This song would be Sanitarium.
Oh, you're right. It is Sanitarium.
One would be
Nothing really
bad.
That's one.
See, I haven't played that in a while.
Yeah. Hold on. Let me see if I can find something. Speaking of one, here's another place in which we can talk about covering music.
Covering music would be a band playing another band's song.
I have a question. Why does like say you were to play a say John Lennon did Imagine, and then he went to go do it in like concert. Why does it sound like so different?
Because when he played the first time, he recorded in a studio, and he had the ability to polish it, make it sound good. He maybe laid down some piano, then threw some drums on, then his vocals. If you go and see it live, you get a live version of it, live and in person, everything. So there's probably going to be some mess ups in there, imperfection.
Yeah.
A lot of people think that's music. A lot of people would rather go to a live concert. I think most people than listen to a studio album. You think you'd rather listen to What It Takes from Aerosmith that you've heard 300 times in your headphones?
Concert, so yeah.
That'd be pretty awesome to see it live.
Because that gives them the ability to change it on the fly, or even just, they can go back and rehearse a change that you won't expect because you've only heard the studio version.
Sometimes I hear songs like on some random show, like they change the song a lot, like when they do it live. It sounds really bad.
Well, it's just a matter of, you know, it's like anything. You try it and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, right?
Well, and you could almost go back to what you said 60 seconds ago, cover, which is really live. They're just covering a version of their own song.
Right. They're doing this. So here is a version of One by Metallica done in a medieval style.
Medieval.
Using instruments that they would have used like 600 years ago.
That's going to be interesting.
It's really interesting. I've got to skip the ad that plays on YouTube. All right. So, it's a live version, but check this out. This is very different. So, he's not playing guitar, he's playing a lute.
It sounds like an acoustic guitar to me.
If they sound very similar. It's the same principle. It's strings stretched over a wooden board. That's a recorder.
It sounds like a piccolo.
It's a recorder. And that's a woodwind instrument. And that works by, you take a special kind of reed and you put it in the front of the instrument, and as you blow into it, that reed vibrates, and that's the vibration that produces the pretty sound that you're hearing here. So this is the same song as Metallica's version of One. All they're doing differently is changing up the instruments that they use. All the notes are actually still the same. So this is what allows for a lot of great variation. So you can combine guitar string types, plucking sounds, with woodwind, reedy, airy type sounds, or violins, which are strings that are vibrated with a bow instead of by plucking them with your hands.
Here's an interesting version of a cover. Let's see if you guys can figure out what this is.
Hold it a little closer, Kyle. Right about there. Yeah. Lord above us, bring your friends. It's fun to lose. And to pretend she's overboard. Selfish. You recognize it?
Maybe I'll know this part right here.
Nirvana.
Yes. This is a version of Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Yep, by Tori Amos. Gotta give her the credit on that one.
Yes. The Muppets also did an awesome version of it.
Of Smells Like Teen Spirit?
Yeah, in the move, not the last one, but the one before, they had a barbershop quartet version.
Yeah, interesting.
Smells Like Teen Spirit. And that's what's kind of a cool thing about music. You can use all of these different tools to create something different.
A lot of times when you're a band and you're starting up and you want to get people to like you, you play original songs and people are going to be like, I don't want to listen to this, I don't know these guys, but then they start playing
some version of something you already know that's different enough.
They're like, oh, I know that. And then they start liking the band. And then they can throw their own songs in there. And then
there's a lot of it. In fact, the Beatles are another good example of that. They're a band that when they first got started, before they ever got famous, they would go into these clubs at night and play for a crowd.
They would play 40 songs, and 35 of them would be old 50s, Buddy Holly, and all that kind of stuff.
In fact, if you listen to their first couple of albums,
half of them are covers.
Right, there's a lot of covers on there. I'm trying to think of some very famous covers they did.
Like Roll Over Beethoven?
Twist and Shout.
Twist and Shout was not the Beatles' original.
Right, they didn't write. And sometimes the cover ends up being more famous than the original one.
I Will Always Love You.
That's a great one. I Will Always Love You by Whitney Houston is, of course, originally written by Dolly Parton. Mm-hmm. Or Jimi Hendrix's version of All Along the Watchtower, everybody knows, but it's actually a Bob Dylan song.
And then you'll also have people like Diane Warren, who's a great songwriter. I think she wrote Had the Time of My Life from Dirty Dancing. She also wrote I Don't Want to Miss a Thing, which Aerosmith and other country bands sing it too. So a lot of different people can play different versions of the same song.
Right, you can get really creative. Well, as long as we were talking about all this different stuff, I kind of wanted to move on. I know it's a total jump, but I think it's time to do our The Internet is Dumb segment. Here we go.
The Internet is Dumb.
All right, so this week I was looking for a musical-themed Internet is Dumb category for a myth. And this one was actually done on MythBusters. It's called the Brown Note. This is a note. So, for example, music, Brandon, is made up of vibrations in the air. And you've probably seen that classic kind of cartoonish trope where an opera singer sings and breaks glass with her voice. You've probably seen something.
Yeah, I've seen that a lot. Is that possible?
It is barely.
It ain't over until the fat lady sings.
That's right.
But continue.
Yeah, it is barely possible to do that, or at least to produce a tone, because every substance in the universe will have a sort of a resonant frequency that it will vibrate at. So, for example, if you vibrate that glass at the right frequency, it's like, think of like you're hitting a punching bag, right? And it swings forward, and then it swings back at you. If you punch it at the right time, you're going to get into a pattern where you punch it farther and swings farther and farther and farther away from you, as long as your timing is right. Make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's what the singer is doing to the glass, right? If you vibrate it at just the right frequency, those vibrations are all going to add up until the glass shatters.
So would you be considered like very talented if you could do that?
Yeah, you'd be pretty good. That's not easy. So the brown note is the idea of like, well, what if you could do that to a person? You vibrate them with some particular frequency until they poop themselves.
Well, you know, there's a lot
that's
of
the brown note.
The frequencies humans can't hear. I mean, that's why, like, a dog who has very sensitive ears, you play these really, really high tones, you can't hear. I remember one time, Brandon, you and I were sitting on the couch and we were trying to figure out tones. And you played these really, really high tones.
Mm-hmm.
I just noticed after a while, we would just be getting a headache and we couldn't even hear it.
Right, and because it's still hitting your ear. Your brain just isn't processing
it.
Don't tell me if the brown note is, like, true or not, but, like, whoever came up with that is, like, really, 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 really stupid.
Well, no, the concept was, well, what if you're, like, in battle, and, like, your enemies are coming out over the hill, and they're like, we're just going to set up a bunch of speakers, play this note, they're all going to poop themselves and go home.
Yeah, we win the war.
We win the war.
But what if you poop yourself? You're not just gonna go home. You're gonna
I'd go home. I want to change my clothes, and then while you're changing clothes, the other country can bomb you.
Yeah.
No, I don't know.
But it doesn't work. Not surprisingly, they did try this on MythBusters, but even a note frequency that is below your ears can hear you. You would think it's got to be a real like low rumbly note to do this. The problem is like something like glass is made up of a very uniform substance, right? All of the molecules in the glass are going to be kind of the same stuff, right? So when they vibrate, they're all going to vibrate at kind of the same frequency. But your body is made up of a whole bunch of different stuff. There's your bones, your organs, your skin, your blood, your all these different pieces. So you're never going to get them all to vibrate at the same time. Now, we could jiggle the crap out of you, and maybe it would work with something super loud, but that would just kill you before it made you do that. So anyway, that's the brown note. I thought it was kind of funny.
Who came up with that?
I have no idea who came up with
that. Because I just want to have a long talk with them about common sense.
Well, that's why we do this segment. We were talking about, before we did that, we were talking a little bit about kind of musical evolution. And I think for most of us, the modern era kind of starts in the 50s because I think that's what our parents were in that. Kyle and I were born in the, well, I was born in 1980. Kyle's a little earlier.
Yeah.
Late 70s?
Late 70s,
okay.
Yeah.
So our parents were born in the 40s. And grew up listening to the music of the 50s and 60s, which is early rock and roll.
Beatles,
right?
Buddy Holly.
Right. But, and if you go a little farther back, you can listen to, say, ragtime, which would be the music of the very early, the turn of... Yeah, that's the kind of music you actually hear it out of, like, ice cream trucks. It's,
yeah,
the Entertainer's the one everyone knows.
Big band music was big. I think it was the 20s or 30s.
Yeah, big band, sure, swing. Into the 40s. Well, Elvis was in the 50s. That's a little bit later.
That's kind of when really pop music started, which was the early 50s, mid-50s.
What we would consider modern rock and roll. In fact, let me see if I can find what's considered the very first rock and roll song. We'll keep talking. But rock and roll, in its earliest stages, was very simplistic.
Was it in the 50s when Marty McFly did...
Probably a little earlier. I'm thinking 52.
That was when Marty McFly invented Chuck Berry. Yeah, according to the movie. So that, but that era, almost everything was a, could you play a 12-bar blues real quick to kind of demonstrate what that is? So 12-bar blues, like any blues song you hear, like B.B. King just died. So it's going to be one, and then jump up, and it goes right back down.
Not done yet.
And then... Right. That's a 12. B.B. King was a blues legend. He passed away just a few months ago. He's one of the most famous blues artists of all time. But if you listen to any blues, or a lot of blues music, not to say that it's all the same, but that is what they call a 12-bar blues because it's a standard building block of a lot of
chord progression.
It's a chord progression.
Sort of started.
Right. That's what a chord progression is, a standardized pattern. Another song, for example, Free Falling by Tom Petty. That's a different chord progression. Okay, so that's a different one. There's lots of different ones that have standard names or designations that make it easy for musicians to pick them up and do them. Even though lots of songs have the same chord progressions as other songs, it doesn't mean they're going to sound exactly the same. However, early rock and roll did sound very,
very
similar.
They very much stuck to the ones, the fours, and the fives of a
right.
chord progression.
Partially, that's because they're easier to play on a guitar.
Easier to sing notes over them, and easy for the brain to figure it out and interpret it, which kind of circles us back around.
Yeah. I'm trying to find who did that song. OG, it's called. Let's see if I can find
it.
God. I think, I don't know, I'm wondering if you're going to play what I'm thinking, but a good example of an early 50s song would be like Rock Around the Clock.
That's a great one.
Rock around the clock.
Yeah, that is, it's again, that is the same. Okay, so here we go. Bill Haley, Rock Around the Clock. Let's play it. So.
Listen to how basic this is, too.
8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. Play.
Minor chord. It's the same 12-bar blues that Kyle just played.
Close to it. Very close.
So it's a variant of that. So there's a lot of songs that use that exact progression.
Mm-hmm.
As you get into the 60s, this was one of the big... You heard there was a lot of like criticism of rock and roll in the beginning. Like adults didn't understand it. Critics didn't like it. They didn't know what to do with it. Part of that was because it was so simplistic that people tended to think, well, this stuff is... It's not that complicated, so it can't be that good.
Here's another song that was one of the big songs to start off a certain type of style in the...
You were talking about like the first rock and roll song. What is that?
It's called OG. And I can't remember the name of the... But it's... How I love that girl. OG. That's considered the very first rock and roll song by some rock historians. But it's just part of an evolution of music. It's not like these guys did this song and then everybody said, hey, let's copy them. But it was one of the forerunners, the same way we did Smells Like Teen Spirit. You've heard that song. That song wasn't the first grunge song by any stretch, but it was the first grunge song to really hit the mainstream consciousness where people heard this and go, this is a new thing. I don't know what this is, but I like it. And it kind of took over.
Kind of like a domino effect?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. In fact...
This song right here, can you believe we're cutting it? Very popular song, was well known in the early 60s for starting the girl groups of the 60s, for getting all the, you know, the famous girl groups.
And this is closer to a song, to a genre called doo-wop, or, which is the forerunner to what you would call R&B today. And one of the things that's interesting about it is the production. The production is what they call a wall of sound. Turn down the volume. So the wall of sound is, it was Phil Spector's idea, who is now more famous for being a murderer. But
what a great songwriter and producer, though.
Yeah, before, his name is Phil Spector. He was responsible for almost every big song of the 50s and 60s you can think of.
Mm-hmm.
His genius was putting together groups like the Supremes and stuff. Mm-hmm. And they got famous because they had this sound that was almost overwhelming. He basically said, we're not going to have any empty spots. We're going to have an entire orchestra behind all of these songs. And if you listen to that song, or, you know, say something like You Can't Hurry Love, or you know, all these, The Temptations, like there's this swelling music behind it. And again, that's all too true.
But after
music.
A while, the thing is it kind of got saturated with all this stuff. And then, you know, the Beatles came, kind of changed it. And then it even got more interesting when you got to the late 60s.
When you got the drugs, yeah. But one of the things the Beatles are most, I think, whether you like their stuff or you don't like their stuff, their influence really can't be understated. Because not only were they very popular, but they were one of the first groups to kind of answer that criticism of, hey, this stuff is too simplistic, by saying, okay, we're going to make this stuff really complicated.
And
Sgt.
Pepper's a magical mystery tour.
Right. You go from songs like...
I Want to Hold Your Hand.
You want to go from I Hold Your Hand to I Am the Walrus.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it's like, whoa.
You know, what's interesting about that is that those songs are probably only 3 or 4 years apart in the grand scheme of the Beatles.
Yeah, if you look at their entire career, they go...
From 62 to what, 1970?
To 70. They broke up in 1970. So in only 8 years, they produced all that music and changed a lot of stuff. And a lot of different music that came after it, they took with them that spirit of inventiveness of going like, okay, we don't have to do it this particular way. We can do just about anything we want. And that really came through, I think, most when you start getting to the 80s and 90s, because what happens is now you get computers into the mix. And now we can, like, the Beatles used to do this stuff in the studio where they would play a guitar solo forwards, and then they would reverse it. And it would go backwards. So a song like I'm Only Sleeping has this weird part in it where the guitar goes like... And it's because the sound is actually being played backwards.
But I want to hear that now.
Huh?
I want to hear that now.
Well, I'll see if I can find it. Probably not. Because I don't think that'll have the Beatles on it. On Spotify. I don't know if Spotify has it. But the point is they had to do that by taking physical audio tape, cutting it out of the song, turning the tape around and splicing it back together so it would play backwards, because that was the technology they had in the mid-1960s. By the time you get to groups like Say you get Depeche Mode in the 80s that are doing very synthesized music, mm-hmm. where the you've got a keyboard like this.
The Oingo Boingo and the Cars. And
or, yeah, the Smiths.
Van Halen.
The Cure.
Van Halen is more of a hard rock.
That's just electric guitars. But you get to a group like The Cure, and they use a lot of synthy sounds. Let me see if I can pull some up while we're talking. So, electronic sounds like this.
It sounds very, like, Nintendo.
A little bit. I mean, that's when Nintendo came out, too. But that was a big invention. It was like, let's use these computers to or electronic instruments to make these kinds of sounds that no one had ever used or heard in music before. And by the time you get to the 90s, you start getting into groups like Radiohead.
Here comes a gig.
Okay, so this is one Depeche Mode's first big hit. And you can hear, none of these instruments are real instruments in that they're not vibrating a string. They are just created with an equation. It's a keyboard like the one in front of me that I push a button and the sound comes out of it, right? Then you get into, like I said, Radiohead, and that's just one example, but the Flaming Lips, like all of these groups that kind of start coming out of the late 90s, they start going into a studio and going, hey, I can use a computer program to take this stuff, and what the Beatles used to do by snipping pieces of tape and playing them backwards and speeding them up physically, I can now use a program to create all kinds of really weird stuff. So I'll play one here. I'll find something that embodies that.
And as you're focused on that, I want to just mention that it's really cool what we've done with technology and music, but you got to really, as a musician.
So listen to this. So this is Feel Good Inc. by the Gorillaz. So there's some real instruments in there, but they're doing things to those sounds that are not the normal way that the instrument would sound. They're bending them, they're changing them. They're using computers to take samples of things and reuse them. And if you keep listening to the song, you'll hear some weirder things. A little bit. There's lots of groups like this. They have now modernized their kind of sound. The Killers are a good example of that, too.
Just somewhere to get into this. Doug, what's your favorite type of music?
That's a good question. My favorite type of music. We have an email on this. So let me do this. Let's go to our listener mail, and I'll kind of come circle around back to that question.
She wrote about it. Return to sender. Address unknown.
I don't want to read all this mail. All
right, so here is our first question. Our first listener question comes from Brandy H. And she says, I've heard classical music helps plants grow. Is this true?
Yeah, no.
That's very questionable. You know, I think at some point there were some tests on that kind of stuff, and I think that someone might have proved that by playing music it actually helped it grow faster.
That was what everybody said. I had to look this up. As far as I can tell, the answer is no.
They could have put bamboo juice on it or something like that.
Yeah, the problem with any experiment like this is you have to account for every variable. So you have to, I mean, it's an easy experiment
better
to
rain,
run.
Better soil, better...
Well, this is an easy experiment to set up, right? You get a whole bunch of plants, you put them under the exact same conditions, except one group gets to hear classical music all the time and the other group gets nothing. And you just see which
music
one is it.
Music
therapy. So,
I just think, like, yes, they're a living thing, but they're not...
They don't hear it.
Yeah, they don't have ear germs. They don't have the little hairs in their ear to vibrate. And...
Well, the question... But they're still, of course, like anything else, they still get vibrated by the music, right? They're still...
So I guess the question would be, can plants respond to music? Is there a way for them to respond?
And then the question is it the music or is it just something about the vibration helps them? In other words, if you were to play any vibration that was mm-hmm. kind of a similar... volume
just
and
this.
Well, I'm about smacking them, but yeah, if you were to play a sound that was, say, just, you know, static, that was roughly the same volume, would that make a difference? I don't know. So
I mean, if there was a one day difference on what's faster, I think you could just say that
it could be a fluke. Yeah, on one day
it could be a fluke, maybe more dirt or something.
Yeah,
well,
you know what?
In every experiment, by the way, no matter what the science is, the way you account for things like that is you do it a lot, right? So instead of just doing it over one day, you do it for a year.
Yeah.
And that would wash out all of the days that something unusual happened, and you get to see the average. Same way when you take like a poll of like, well, do people like this kind of music? If you ask 10 people, that's not really enough. If you ask a million people, then you're going to get a better sense.
Yeah, like when I had to do my science project, instead of testing just like my science teacher said, like five people, well, just so happens those five people could have the same interest instead of like 20 or 50 or...
Yeah, the more people you bring, or the more data you collect, the more you have to get to what's called statistically significant. In other words, with only a few people, you don't know if, you know, this is an average group or if some of them are freaks, right? Like some of this data could be really outside the norm, but you need more data to find out what the norm is. And that's just good scientific principle.
Going back to like the emotion, I know we'll get back to our questions here in a second, this is like, do people respond to music the same way? Let's say you took two baby boys that were 1 year old and you put them on a deserted island, now two separate deserted islands until they were seven, assuming mm-hmm. that they were able to get by and live, and you're both to play for them a certain song, would they react the same way to that song?
Well, that's the good question, right? Is it genetics that predisposes us to a particular type of music? Or it's called nature versus nurture, right? Is it because, you know, I like certain music because when I was growing up, my parents liked certain music. They played this stuff for me, and so that was what I grew up hearing.
I mean,
and so
that's how I am. Like, most kids like, you know, like R&B and rap. I like what my dad likes, which is like 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s,
wow,
like rock.
Your dad likes good music. He must be cool.
He must be a really smart guy.
I don't know. My dad's not here right now.
Tell him we said hi.
Yeah. All right. So this kind of feeds into the next question. This is from Claudio S. He says, why does some music seem to give you tingles down your spine in a good way, and other types of music instantly aggravate you? So before we get into what music you do like and what music you don't, I really thought this was an interesting question. So I did a little digging. So what it turns out is between the ages of 10 and 20, that's when you're really transitioning from being a kid to an adult, right? During that transition, your body's going through a lot of changes,
puberty.
There's puberty, so there's a lot of hormones, but there's also a lot of like formative experiences you're having for the first time. There's a lot of pressures in life. And what that means is you're very impressionable. So the music that you come across during this time in your life is more likely to resonate with you because you're having emotional experiences. So I can think very clearly of songs that had a big influence on me when I was growing up, or albums that like I listened to over and over and over and over again, that, you know, because I was born in 1980.
Where you were at the time.
I think like me and my dad, who are, he's not here right now, we were watching this TV show on like video games or like consoles. Like, it's not like that the Nintendo was the best. It's like, it was like the best times of your life. Like,
yeah.
That made it the best.
But I think it's because the people at that time were the first people to do it. I mean...
And it's also because it was the age you were at the time that came around.
Like, right now, I would say the Xbox, and that's just...
And this is going to be the best time of your life.
Yeah.
That's the point. It has to do with... It's not so much to do with the art or the technology.
No.
It's your age. It's the age at which these things...
Where you are when you heard that sound and what was going on.
Right. So what I found is the research shows... If you expose yourself to a lot of different types of music between those ages, you're more likely to have a broader template to appreciate new music later on. So when you're 30, you might encounter a new band or a new piece of music, even if it's something old, like a piece of classical music. If you didn't have a very broad experience when you were younger, you don't have as much of a musical template to associate that with. So to answer the question about things giving you tingles down your spine... It's the things that give you tingles down your spine are going to be those things that either are the things you encountered when you were younger, or most closely remind that there's something about them that brings you back to that moment in time. So, for example, for me, I remember growing up that like there was a point in which I kind of discovered REM, and I really really liked that band. And so now when I find like indie bands, like the ones that I like are the ones that definitely harken back to that particular band. Because of my experience. And Brandon, the same thing is going to be true for you. 15 years from now, some new band is going to come along, and whether or not it either gives you the tingles down your spine or makes you change the channel is going to be directly related to what did you listen to now. So I think the takeaway is listen to as much as possible, because there's all kinds of interesting stuff out there waiting to be discovered.
But another thing to think about also, Claudia, who was asking about
Claudio. Sorry.
That tingle down your spine is just like the basics of like, if you were to hear like, you know, nails on a on a chalkboard, you want to run. But if you just hear like a perfect harmony, like two voices singing a nice, pretty, you know, two tones together, I mean, that's enough to bring chills down my spine.
Yeah, and again, for release.
I think it's like Beethoven.
Yeah, that's for release by Beethoven that you were humming there. And see, that's a great example of something that piece of music is 200 years old. And everybody still knows it.
Everyone still knows it.
I like that song.
And the reason is because there's something about that piece of music. I mean, you can hear every bit of emotion that Beethoven wants you to hear. It's a very delicate, light piece with just a hint of sadness in it, right?
It affects people. I mean, another great example of something that affects people, and not only because of the lyrics, but a great melody, is the Star Spangled Banner.
Sure. Everybody knows it, at least if you're listening in America, I'm sure you know it. And it's actually based on an old English drinking song, so if you're in England, you might know that one. The melody is actually the same, believe
really
it or not.
Old English drinking song?
Yep, that's true.
I thought some guy was like in war.
Well, he wrote the words, but the melody was actually, they took an English drinking song and they kind of changed it around slightly.
Time signature for that song, not solid 4/4. What do you think it is, just really quick?
Oh, man, I have no idea.
There's
is it 3/4?
It's 3, because oh, say, can you see? 2, 3.
1, 2, 3. So that's that's also like, if you hear like waltzes, like that's
exactly
a very waltz time signature. So there's a song that everybody knows. And again, it's an old song, but it puts you into a certain mood. Now, that song puts you in a particularly patriotic mood because of the subject
matter.
Really,
because of the lyrics is what does that.
But if you had never heard that song before, and you didn't hear the words, and you had no idea it was a piece of national pride.
Probably wouldn't do the same trick, would it?
But it might not make you feel, you know, national pride, rah, rah, America. But it's definitely a booming major chord piece that it soars. The melody goes up and down and soars, and that kind of thing still speaks to you. So,
but going back though, I mean, when it comes down to it, it's like you said originally, it's what you grew up to and what you heard. I mean, like for me, like if I'm to listen to something like, you know, I mean, there's Metallica songs, there's Guns N' Roses songs that to a lot of people, like, it's annoying, but it puts chills down my spine because that's where I was at the time. When I was 12 years old, I was listening to Sweet Child of Mine and Patience and Welcome to the Jungle.
Right, and I'm never going to get my grandmother to like those songs. As hard as I try, she will never come around on that. She wants to hear the big band sounds that were popular because when she was that age, in the 40s, those were the songs that were tearing up the radio then. That everybody knew.
Seriously, I got people I work with, and you know, I mean, not just work with, a lot of people I know in their late 20s, 30s, everyone knows the 90s music. Everyone knows, you know, like.
And it's because they were the right age.
Nirvana's a little bit older. I think of Nirvana as more of a Generation X, like born in the 70s kind of thing.
It's, yeah, I'm right at I'm about as young as you could be, because I was born in 1980, so Nirvana hit in 1991. So I was 11. But I still remember everything I heard on the radio changed overnight.
Do you remember that? How all of a sudden when Smells Like Teen Spirit came on the radio, it affected. Everyone that was 12 to 17 years old totally affected
by
that song.
Well, because you think about the music that was playing before. You hear like Poison playing Motley Crue.
Bon Jovi.
Overnight they became irrelevant.
By 1993, nobody wanted those bands anymore.
No.
You would not hear Winger or Warrant on the radio 3 years after they had a hit because everyone thought it was lame.
Right, and all of a sudden, Pearl Jam comes around. Soundgarden.
Alice in Chains.
Alice in Chains.
I hate Pearl Jam.
Oh, man, they're so good. But see, again, my personal taste for Pearl Jam might be more affected by the fact of I was your age, actually, when that first album hit.
Brandon, I think he was telling me earlier today about Pearl Jam, because we were talking about this before we went on the air, is that it's actually Eddie Vedder's vocals. You do appreciate the music, right?
I like the background, but like my dad, he talks to me about, like, he tries to get me to like the voice, but I hate
his
voice.
How old's your dad?
Like 48.
Yeah, that's weird then.
Not quite.
Yeah.
So anyway, let me get to the last email here because we got to wrap this up soon. But the last email is from Matt C, and he wants to know: is there a way to use science to develop better music?
Well, I just have to say, like, since the science is getting better, mm-hmm. Well, you go from Beatles, then you go from like Led Zeppelin, which is still like good, like I guess Pearl Jam. Then you go to, like, gangster Snoop Dogg, so no, it's terrible. Like,
but again, see, that's all a matter of personal taste, right? Because,
really,
like, there's going to be plenty of people, I mean, those artists are very popular, and they're going to say, no, you're missing, you know, there's the thing that makes this music special to me You know, you're not hearing what
it's
I
drug
hear.
Addiction.
Well, no, I have not to say that I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and when it comes to music, I will say that, and a lot of people might be very against what I'm going to say right now, and that's okay, but to me, like, Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre is not music. However, I do believe that it's great. I believe I can listen to it, and I get a certain vibe. I feel like I want to get going. I hear, like, Gin and Juice. You know,
it puts you in a mood.
It's very effective. To me, it's not music either. My dad says it's just not like.
Your dad's pretty smart, but I mean, I would say.
Well,
the same
it's music, but it doesn't have a melody. It's missing a melody, but that's the definition of what rap music is. It's just spoken word.
It's a great form of expression, whether you call it music or not. I mean, there's talent there.
But it's a sound, and it's a sound that has a pattern that is designed to make you feel something. So definitely. I would say it is music. But to answer the question about science. This all goes back to science, as far as music is concerned. It might allow us to develop new, interesting kinds of instruments or to use a studio software and equipment to make interesting sounds we've never heard before, but that doesn't necessarily make the music itself better.
If they can actually test a way by, I don't know, hooking the brain up to something to see how it reacts to certain things and then eventually putting the right sounds and incorporating together, maybe they can make better music by just testing.
Well, they've done that to a degree. They can figure out, like, for example, what are chord progressions people tend to respond to more, but you can't, I think you can use science to create new artistic tools, but as far as the underlying quality of the creativity, that's not good. I mean, human creativity has been pretty much the same. All you've done is just swap out the toolkit.
Change it down a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so I would say science, I know that science can develop quote-unquote better music, because I think, you know, there's artists that come along today that are just sitting there with an acoustic guitar writing stuff, and they're great. And they don't, you know, the quality of what they're doing isn't lessened by the fact that they're not using technology to do that. And even if we can find an equation that will create the perfect song, do we want that song?
No, I think it's more of emotion-driven music. I think it's going to be very hard for science to find it.
Yeah, I think this is an area where science, just, there's a limit to what we can do. So
great question, though.
Yeah, I think it's a great question.
Before we go, like...
Mm-hmm. Oh, we should talk about, yeah, what you wanted to ask, what do we like?
Favorite music?
Genre? If I had to choose one, it would probably be classic rock. That was my first love in high school, was finding The Who, which is a phenomenal band that I love very, very much. So if I had to pick one thing, that would be it.
What about you, Kyle?
You know, for me, I grew up on the Beatles, and I definitely would say that they're my favorite band, but I really like the way that a band like Weezer has taken very simple music and made it hard and edgy. I like very basic music with an edge, with a grr behind it.
That's where, like, punk comes in, too. You get, like, it's punk is not complicated, it's loud and angry, but it's still awesome.
Green Day is probably one of the most simplest bands you've ever... I mean, if you put that down on piano, I mean, or on just a guitar, there's three or four chord progressions with basic melodies, but it really does affect.
You and my dad have the same taste.
Interesting, I gotta meet him sometime.
Yeah. Brandon, how about you? You said your favorite was Aerosmith. Any others that you really love?
Well, what Kyle said, I really like all that. I mean, I'm not a big, like, Weezer. I don't really know. But I didn't grow up on the Beatles, but I like the Beatles. I like a little bit of Led Zeppelin, like Aerosmith and Nirvana, old stuff. I don't like rap and R&B.
Well, I would say, since you're now in that 10 to 20 age range, keep an open mind. Find an artist that people talk about as being legendary. So you said you don't particularly like R&B, but I'm guessing you haven't really, say, sit down and listen to, like, Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life, like, you know, or Talking Book, one of his great albums, and you'll start to hear, like, oh man, there's something working here, and you can find what is it that works about an artist like Stevie Wonder, or early, say, Michael Jackson stuff.
Very
early. I like Michael Jackson.
Okay, so if you like Michael Jackson, then you do like R&B, it's just a different part of R&B. But go beyond that. Find reggae. Find punk. Find classical. Find blues. Like, just listen to some of this stuff, because I guarantee you, no matter what the genre, there is at least one or two songs in there that will make you really just pop your eyeballs open and go, I can't believe I never heard this before. And it's great, because you're setting yourself up to be receptive to those things later.
So you, Brandon, you're 12, right?
Yes, almost 13.
So I'm sure that you know how the kids around your friends. Is it a certain type of style? I'm guessing that it's probably rap, but what is most kids like these days?
Well, it's rap, and I just think, I don't know if they like it as much as they like it because of the popularity. It's popular. Like, I say I know 100 kids that like rap.
Yeah.
how many of them actually like it, and how many of them like the popularity?
Well, that, how many of them are posers?
Yeah. What worries me about that is just the lack of melody going forward as we go into the future here. It's kind of, I'm nervous. 50 years from now, what are we going to be?
Well, that's the thing. I think we're on a lot. What's the music? And this is a not a music science question, but a music business question, which is there are now lots and lots of different genres. I mean, yes, hip hop is popular, but there's still a lot of pop music that's popular. Country music is still popular. There's new genres that are going to form and that you've never, you know, stuff you can't even conceive of. That just the way that like my grandparents could never have pictured hearing a band like
Axl Rose. Voice.
Sure, you couldn't conceive of that in the 1930s. So there's stuff coming down the pike for us that is going to be super inventive.
Well, it's interesting how technology's taken it too, because if you go back to when we were kids, or even when we were young adults in our early 20s, it's like, if you were a band and you want to have a hit song, you got to go play a bunch of shows, you got to get a fan base, and you got to, you know, eventually sell some albums. But now
you can go on YouTube
and play one song and you get a million hits and you're a star.
Justin Bieber.
Yeah.
Perfect example.
Great example. So anyway, I think that'll do it for this podcast. I know we covered a lot of ground, so I wanted to thank you both. But before we go, a couple of things. One, if you like what we do here, check us out. Subscribe on iTunes. Go to quarksandrec.com, which is our website. If you have questions, you can send them through there. You can go to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/quarksandrec, or tweet us at quarksandrec. And our next episode coming up is going to be on Pluto.
Pluto.
Which is pretty cool.
Wait, you mean you're going to do one on Mickey's dog?
Yeah,
Mickey's
dog. I was thinking that like we could talk about why you never really heard him bark.
Yeah, he's pretty quiet.
I think that's pretty racist towards Goofy.
That's true. Look, they're both dogs. We'll save it for the Pluto podcast. But yes,
Goofy is a mouse, isn't he?
No, Goofy's also a dog, which is weird. In exactly 25 days from when we're recording this, humanity's very first probe to Pluto is going to go whizzing right by it. So we're going to go overnight from knowing almost nothing about Pluto to knowing everything that we can hopefully know about Pluto.
When do you think it'll be like
July 14th?
Get to know like about Pluto more.
Well, like I said, on July 14th, our probe is going to be at closest approach. And for a few months after that, I mean, we're going to keep getting data in from the probe. So by the time we record the podcast, we should have a lot of really awesome information to share about Pluto. So anyway, that'll do it for our music podcast. I'm Doug.
I'm Bridget.
And thanks so much, Kyle, for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's been fun.
All right.
Thank you, Kyle.
See you later. And in the end